Hey everyone, this is Cameron from Renegade Animation on renegadepopculture.com. If you like what we do, please give us a like, a follow, a rating, and share out our work on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to us. We are everywhere. And if you can, consider supporting our Patreon. That way we can keep doing what we love, and that's catching up on the world of adult animation in 2023. And now, on with this new year.
What's going on, everyone? Welcome to a brand new episode of Renegade Animation on the Renegade Pop Culture Podcast Network. My name is Mike. I'll be your host this evening. Joining me, as always, is the animation guru himself, Cameron.
Howdy, howdy.
And yes, welcome to the new year. But before we really dive into 2024, we have some unfinished 2023 business, particularly in talking about the state of adult animation. We have a couple shows to highlight coming up. We've got Scavenger's Reign, Scott Pilgrim Takes Off, and Carol and the End of the World. But before we get there and the larger conversation about the year that was for adult animation, Cameron, why don't you tell us about this week's Indie Spotlight?
So, our indie spotlight for this episode, we'll be talking about the currently ongoing sci-fi comedy series right now called Monkey Wrench by Joshua and Ashley Palmer. Essentially, what this show is, it's about these two bounty hunters, Shrike Sanchez and Bulldog Browns, as they pilot and run the mercenary group called Monkey Wrench. And space-time shenanigans ensue. There are three episodes out right now. The newest one literally came out like last week before we recorded all this, and it's you can either watch it on Newgrounds, man, remember that, or catch it on YouTube. And they are currently looking for funding for episode four. What I like about this show is how different it is from the other adult animated series on YouTube and in the indie animation scene. Monkey Wrench is a lot more energetic and action-packed compared to the more drama and comedy-driven shows like Hell of a Boss. And I personally like Monkey Wrench a little more than a lot of the indie pilots that have come out these past few years. Not that I still don't love the other ones, but Monkey Wrench scratches an itch that I've been looking for within the indie animation scene with its very different setup, character archetypes, and I mean, we have our hot-headed lead with a mysterious past with Shrike Sanchez and his more level-headed brains of the operation, Bulldog. You also have the lovable and you know you gotta love to hate him, Scratch and his brother Scritch, and the sci-fi bounties that they go on. The first episode is a delightful, chaotic escort mission that I think has one of the best punchlines in comedy of this recent decade of animation, where they have to take this very neurotic parrot guy and take him to another location so he can avoid the troubles of whatever the ghost egg is that they keep hearing about. And by the third episode, it starts to get a little more complex. You dive into the characters a little more with their mindsets and backstories. But it feels more cohesive. It doesn't feel like it has that shift in tone as something like Hell of a Boss has, with you go from its first season to its second season. Like I said, I still love Hell of a Boss, but there are definitely some things about it I think need to. The creatives there need to be careful about.
In terms of the style, just to give an idea of like what to expect, how would you compare this to maybe like other series that maybe stuff that we grew up with?
If you like more sci-fi comedy stuff, like the Earthworm Jim TV show, it's kind of like that, where the writing and jokes are more in the dialogue than they don't focus on stuff like sex jokes and crass humor. A lot of it is based around the characters that interact with one another. The love and hate relationship Scratch and Shrike have, and Bulldog just trying to keep everything together. Or if you like your sci-fi adventures, like your Star Wars, your Clone Wars, your Outlaw Stars, your cowboy bebops, but mixed with a more US cartoon identity, then you'll love this show. Definitely big for fans of Outlaw Star. There are definitely some things about it that remind me of, like the ship, but you'll have to watch the third episode to see what I mean about that.
That's good because I was a huge fan of Outlaw Star, so anything that comes even close to bearing resemblance to that gets me excited.
Their advertising campaign for the new plushies for Scratch and Scritch is hilarious because they're like, due to a recent new episode coming out, we are completely out of money. You know what that means? Capitalism. And cute plushies. I love a show that has its personality on its sleeve. It's got a lot going on, and I can't wait to see more. And I hope the fourth episode gets funded because you have to continuously support these shows, y'all. They don't have a government art fund or a huge backing from years ago and such. Like, a lot of these need the constant support to make their episodes. And even the creators, before the third episode was released, went on Twitter and explained what went into making the recent episode. And even for like a TV length episode for 50 grand, that's still small. And that's one of the hurdles that indie animation is going to have to get over and overcome by means of either constant support or better art funds and art programs from different countries and states, what have you. So definitely give Monkey Wrench a watch. I highly recommend it. The three episodes I saw are spectacular.
You heard it here first, guys. Go support Monkey Wrench.
But now we get to talk about the state of adult animation from 2023. And I think we hit a point of there was so much going on with the adult animation scene in terms of the different types of shows that we watched and or talked about last year. I don't think we're going to see that again for a while.
A year this good and this diverse, it almost feels too good to be true, at least in terms of this being the quote unquote new normal. I am very appreciative of the fact that even the three shows that we'll be discussing today may have similar themes, but each have their own unique identities.
At first, with the year, it started off pretty okay. Like, you had your usual Farzar and Paradise PD ending. And, well, both shows are now done because Netflix canceled their contract and relationship with the creators. But, like, slowly throughout the year, there was like an uptick on the different types of adult shows that were getting made. We had stuff like Dig Man, the action adventure comedy starring and produced by Andy Samberg, which is basically Indiana Jones romancing the stone in all that stuff. And we also had stuff like Royal Crackers, which doesn't reinvent the wheel, but was executed in a way that was still delightful, even though it could have just been any other kind of typical adult animated series out there. Even the ones that I didn't care for, like Velma and Mulligan, at least were they didn't work for me in different ways. They weren't just like they're shocking, offensive, mean-spirited in the worst way possible. Mulligan was an attempt to be this funny political comedy about what would happen if like an everyday man actually defeated an alien invasion, but it turns out that it's basically Mark Wahlberg, like who gets to run the world and such. Agent Elvis, while more style over substance, and unfortunately was part of the Netflix chopping block from last year, had the great art style to it. And I did end up enjoying most of it for what it was.
I don't like saying the word style over substance, but in this case, I like the art style and sort of the high concept more than I ended up liking the execution. I think it got a little bit wonky in the middle, but the beginning and the end, I really enjoyed.
And then we started getting more methodical and adult shows like Fired on Mars. I think Fired on Mars was like the canary in the coal mine in terms of that, where we got this philosophical quandary of how do you find your use in a place where you were brought on to do something specific, but then you lost your purpose because of capitalistic nonsense. And then after that, it was just kind of like the gates were opened. So we got our typical adult animated stuff. But then near the end of the year, they just kind of put all of these shows together. We had stuff like Blue Eye Samurai, then the sort of adult, quote unquote, because, you know, they put it on Adult Swim. Take that with a grain of salt with My Adventures with Superman, which focused more on the relationship dynamics and a different take on the Superman lore. And then, like, Captain Fall was a dry comedy thriller about a unsuspecting ship captain who just happens to be the captain of a ship that does a bunch of really shady stuff. Fiona and Cake takes the whimsical world of Adventure Time and drops us into a more sober and complicated journey of finding that drive in your life and how you handle the results of your previous actions. Pluto takes the in general lighthearted Astro Boy series, gives it to the author of the acclaimed Monster manga, and turns Astro Boy's most iconic story arc and fills it to the brim with commentary about war, trauma, pride, PTSD, and our connections with nature and science. Something that we will definitely be talking about with the three shows we are going to focus on. Scavenger's Reign, which is a sci-fi horror drama about a group of humans on an alien planet having to survive and make their way to their crashed ship to get off the planet. Carolyn and the End of the World, which is about a middle-aged woman who decides to venture forth into the world because of a planet-sized planet that's going to collide into Earth in 7 months. And then Scott Pilgrim Takes Off, which was probably one of the most divisive takes on adult animation this year, which does an entirely uprooted retelling and different story for the original Scott Pilgrim franchise. Something happened here. Some executive said, we're going to let you make these shows, and we're going to let you do carte blanche on it.
You get carte blanche to do whatever the hell you want.
These adult shows, alongside Blue Eye Samurai, Captain Fall, Dig Man, this is the stuff that we keep talking about, the stuff that we need to see more of. Well, we are going to see more Blue Eye Samurai because it got greenlit for season two. And then, of course, there's the Castlevania Nocturne series that was also really good. We'll have to talk about that another time. With Scavenger's Reign, it feels like a French experimental sci-fi experience, like from the vibe of it, because it looks like something made by a studio in Europe. It's quiet. It's all about stuff like the connection between humans, humans and nature, nature and science, the corruption of pride, and what toxic traits do to people. It's a beautiful show. It's mostly just these characters venturing through this diverse planet of life forms, making sure not to die, but to also survive and to discover themselves a little as they make their way to this ship.
Almost kind of feels like an adult version of Disney's Strange World mixed with, like you said, the sort of French experimental sort of art style, but also like the seriousness of hard sci-fi shows like The Expanse or For All Mankind, where it's really more about relationships these characters have with the Demeter and all of their individual reasons why they need to get back to the ship. And also just kind of throughout their journey, we get to see all of their shortcomings.
Yeah, it's a show that was way more interested in focusing on the pros and cons of our characters. And you don't get a lot of that, because a lot of what people identify as adult animation are the shows that are trying to be shocking. They're trying to be edgy and mean. They're copying Family Guy or South Park, but they don't quite do anything with those premises. They're just trying to be as loud and in your face as possible. But here in these two other shows, they're the exact opposites. You get breathtaking landscape shots and very intimate interactions with the humans with the nature around them. Even though there are some moments that you can define as quote unquote funny, it's more about challenging the viewer with how they define their life and who they are as an individual. Carol in The End of the World is all about connection with other humans, with how we see ourselves with either coworkers, friends, family, and how they see us. Or like how we can have personal connection to items that are otherwise just items. Like one of my favorite episodes, and the one episode that has been pretty much summed up as like one of the best episodes of TV ever for Carol of last year, was episode 4, where the whole story is told about Carol and her relationship with her sister through a recording that Carol's sister did throughout their backpacking trip.
I think this is one of the best episodes, and probably the one where I finally got the vibe of this series. Because at first, I was not sure I was going to like this. I was getting a little bit impatient with Carol's meek, shy, melancholic aura that surrounds her. I was worried that like the whole show was going to be like that, but this is one of those series that you have to stick with till the end because it will surprise you with not just the other characters that she meets, but all of the other adventures that she embarks on in the days and months leading up to. And that's the other thing, they don't ever show the impact. It's just kind of a ticking clock that demonstrates the passing of time.
Really, the part of Carol in The End of the World that starts clicking is when she starts getting a job at an office firm, which sounds funny in of itself, especially when her coworker, Donna, voiced by Kimberly Herbert Gregory, says, "Welcome to the distraction," which this office job represents a distraction from the end of the world to keep people busy. But in another episode that was really good, you see that the office was also like the whole episode is about lost and found items, and where the whole moral is sometimes you need to let things be lost so they can be found. And everyone working at the office were lost because, yeah, how do you handle the end of the world happening? When you have a minute amount of time left on Earth, how do you approach that? And a lot of them found solidarity with just doing office work, even if that office work is absolutely pointless in a world where the world is about to end.
At the end of that episode, where it zooms out, and pretty much the entire floor of the office is just one floor of this like abandoned, I want to say it's like a mall or something.
It's like a multi-floored building. It's like where multiple businesses rent out different floors for their companies and such. And what's also fun about Carol in The End of the World, it's not a dystopian future kind of thing. Nobody's making groups or organizations or cults. Everyone is just living life. There's no war or like it never goes Mad Max. Some people are just enjoying life in the nude. There's a lot of nudity in this show, but it never feels tacky or tasteless.
It's just so matter of fact, which I found interesting.
Exactly. Then another episode I really loved and that like drives this whole theme of connection home is when we focus on Eric, voiced by Michael Chernus, who a lot of y'all would know from Orange is the New Black as Piper's brother. He goes on a trip with his son to meet his ex-wife at Niagara Falls. And it becomes just quiet, very wholesome and endearing reconnection of the son and dad. That at the end of the day, the dad finds out that the mom is not actually at Niagara Falls, but the son was just trying to find some way to get his dad out of his depression and just, you know, being on the couch again. And well, as it's implied in the first episode, when we meet Eric, he likes to make a lot of Denver omelets. The show is funny in the most subtle way. It's not loud. It's not bombastic. It's not edgy. So dry. Then you find out more about characters like Louise, voiced by Mel Rodriguez, and Michael, the nurse and third person in the throuple of Carol's parents, voiced by Delbert Hunt, about like why he's with Carol's parents in a professional and romantic way, and how his words actually inspired the ship captain on his cruise ship to actually just bail, which is funny in its own way. But also, like, sometimes we get into that rut and we need to hear someone who has found that passion and drive in their life to ignite your drive to go find what you need to look for. Now, with Scott Pilgrim Takes Off, the twist being and what drove a fan base down the middle was how, for the first episode, Scott Pilgrim dies. He loses. And then it becomes this deconstruction of the Scott Pilgrim story where the evil X's falls apart. The first evil X essentially becomes the head honcho, the number one guy, while Jason Schwartzman's character like falls apart in shambles, or as far as you know, he does. And we follow Ramona's journey of finding out what happened to Scott, but also to reconnect with evil exes. And it becomes about how their relationships weren't healthy and how they broke up weren't great. The human connection there with how they handled their relationship, what they thought of their relationship, and how they just moved on or had a lack of moving on. Which, listen, I know a lot of people were just wanting an adaptation of the original story, but, and I know I'm probably going to get hate for this because a lot of people like the graphic novels and a lot of people really love the movie. There are aspects of the original property that do not hold up. And the fact that priority number one was to make sure Ramona was more of a character was a good start.
When I said that Scott Pilgrim Takes Off is the best adaptation of the source material, I meant it wholeheartedly because, well, A, you have Brian Lee O'Malley returning to co-create this series, but also there are aspects of the original source material that don't really hold up. And even the original creator was a young guy. He was in his when he wrote this. So this is a chance to have a conversation with both the graphic novel and the movie. Give each of these characters more development than, for the most part, than they've gotten previously.
Because even like with the truncated runtime of the movie, you never got a sense of who these characters were. They had outlandish personalities, but those outlandish personalities were very one note. At least in the movie, they were. Gideon Grace was just the psychotic, manipulative dirtbag. Lucas Lee was just every meathead character you could think of. Todd Ingram was the hipster, I'm a vegan, so I'm better than you person. Mae Whitman was just the angry ex-lover character. You don't even get like a sense of what the Katayanagi twins were like. They were just super smart and, oh, there's a Double Dragon reference. It's not a whole lot to go off of. And unfortunately, I feel like that's kind of the problem here. This series is only 8 episodes, or at least as we for now, it's 8 episodes because all three of these shows have a stinger ending of there being a potential second season or second part to the story. The Katayanagi twins, there's nothing really interesting about them. You don't really get what their relationship was like with Ramona. You learn more about their bond with Scott in the future than their dynamic outside of being their assistants, teachers of this robotics class that Ramona took one time.
Just like Envy Adams, they're the only characters who get the least development. Everyone else, you get to understand a little bit more about their personality and why perhaps it didn't work out with Ramona.
Like, I think the best episode was the one where Roxy Richter and Ramona fight in the video store. I think that's like the best episode of the bunch.
It's certainly one of
Because,
my favorites.
and then the Lucas Lee episode is the second best for me because they got the most screen time or the most out of their fleshed out development. Wallace Wells, I forgot how much of a punk he is. Like, he was entertaining, which made him more tolerable than most, but it was so funny how he was kind of the worst, but got better as the show went on, even though if he was still very smug. But that's what I like about this show. They play up different parts of the dynamics from the original source material. I loved Steven Stills and Knives Chow together. I thought they had a very cute dynamic together, not in a dating way, but just how, because of Scott dying and, of course, Knives finding out about Scott being a dirtbag, how Stills and Knives form this like symbiotic brother and sister, best friend kind of connection.
I love how she discovers her own musical abilities, and the scene where she is playing around with a bass, and Kim's like, "When did you learn the bass?" She's like, "What time is it? 4 o'clock? Yeah, about 4 hours ago."
That was a great jam session. This show is still full of that vibrant energy that you want from Scott Pilgrim and the likes of Science Saru stepping in to make this show. And I know there was like that stupid debate about is this anime or not? It's anime. It was made by a Japanese studio. Anime is just another name for animation. And sooner or later, Science Saru was going to get attached to a Scott Pilgrim, or they were going to make a show that had vibes and a visual style to Scott Pilgrim.
A better successor to Fooly Cooly than all the other Fooly Cooly sequels.
Yeah, like I haven't seen those, but yeah, pretty much just from the reception of those. And, you know, they probably should have gone into FLCL property instead because that fits their tone more than what the studios that did have to work on that. So, but that's another topic for another time. But back to these three shows, though. I like that we get a little more action. It's not just hyper violent action either. With Scott Pilgrim, you have the video game over the top anime style action. Like I said, I think the rental store fight is the best fight in the show. Well, next to the fighting the old Scott Pilgrim at the end of the series. But like Scavenger Rain really reinforces how the people on that planet are not safe. The cute things that are there could also kill you. They did a good job of reinforcing the threat level of Scavenger's Reign because they could have just been like, what? Oh, cool. Look at this. Whatever. Let's keep moving. But the way the human characters interact with the world around them was so good. Just with how they make you feel immersed in this world. It's like if you made a plot to one of those fictional documentary series of like, oh, we sent a ship and a camera to this alien planet, and we documented all of these real alien creatures that are there.
My one criticism of Scavenger's Reign is the heel turn that Chris has towards the end of the series, it can feel a little bit forced because before that, I really just liked how anything on this planet could have killed them, and that alone would have been enough of like a threat. But we have to have some sort of human antagonist, or else there would be little to no drama.
No, I get it. And she kind of gets her comeuppance in the Stinger ending, where she was basically almost left to die on that ship after that beautiful white flower that you see bloom everywhere where there are dead bodies, like takes over the ship and could have taken her over also. But I get it. It's like we should have had either no antagonist or the heel turn needed to be earlier than when we got it. What I also like about these three shows, more so Carol and Scavenger's Reign, is that they have big names. They have recognizable faces as the characters for these shows. But I was never distracted by the fact that they had celebrity cast members for them. I liked Sunita Mani as Ursula. I liked Wunmi Mosaku as Ozzy. Alia Shawkat as Levi the robot, and you all know her from, oh, what was it? Search Party? Yeah, Search Party. Bob Stevenson was also really good. Ted Travelstead, and it was such a good, grounded cast. They were not chosen because they were the biggest names that they could get.
They were just really good actors.
They were the right choice for the roles at hand. And Carol in The End of the World, what a delightful cast that they got for the different characters. It's like Martha Kelly. I liked the different cast members that they got for this one. Like you have like Beth Grant and Lawrence Pressman as Carol's parents, Kimberly Herbert Gregory as Donna, Mel Rodriguez, Bridget Everett, Michael Chernus, Sean Giambrone, and Laurie Metcalf as the HR lady from the business. But there's also the surprisingly fun casting of Tim Heidecker as the two bosses at the office building.
I was wondering who that was.
Yeah, that was Tim Heidecker. I could tell that voice is recognizable. But right there, also, they were chosen because they fit the role. They made the most sense. We even get like a sort of Captain Phillips reunion with one of the actors and a. Like a parody retelling of Captain Phillips, where we see Barkhad Abdi return as a pirate captain. But the twist of that is where it's just these people are tired of running this work and life of constant risk and life and death. And they just want to live life. You even get like fun little cameos from actors like Danny Pudi, Gillian Jacobs, and LeVar Burton. And there's even like Kurtwood Smith and Stephen Colbert make an appearance. But you'd never know that from the characters that they play because there's no like, oh, here's the guest star for this episode. No, they're just like, here's Alison Brie. She's going to show up for an episode for as a minor character or whatever. And I like that because sometimes when you see casting done in movies, it's always the sense of these are the biggest names. Let's put them in there. Screw whatever happens.
That, or they're just like extremely typecast to play a very specific character.
Unfortunately, I think Scott Pilgrim had the weakest casting for me. Not that it wasn't a fun idea to bring back everyone from the movie, but you can tell, and again, these are all talented people. You can tell who was and could do voice work over the ones who really couldn't. And it's not any of their faults. Aubrey Plaza is a great actor. I love her. But she has one tone, and her character is very one note. Her character becomes more interesting as the show goes on, but her acting alongside Mary Elizabeth Winstead felt the most wooden to me.
Which is weird because I thought Plaza was really good in Little Demon.
Yeah, she was really good in that. She did a great job in that. And it's not like she doesn't have voice work experience before. She's shown up in like The Legend of Korra or from up on Poppy Hill, Monsters University, or SpongeBob SquarePants. But here, I don't know what happened there. Maybe Ramona is just meant to be this chill, one level kind of person, but for the more emotional moments, Mary Elizabeth Winstead was more hit and miss with me, but that's just how I felt. I think this was her first voiceover performance, but like I thought like Michael Cera, Brandon Routh, and Chris Evans were way better.
Obviously, Mae Whitman is a voice acting veteran. She's been in pretty much everything that we've grown up with.
Yeah, it's just I thought the voice acting was hit and miss as the show went on, even though these are all super talented people, and maybe there just wasn't much to their characters and such. I don't know. I haven't seen the comic or remember much of the movie. Like, you have Anna Kendrick here, and you see her performance from Trolls Band Together and here as Stacey Pilgrim. Okay, she just didn't have a lot to work with.
I wonder how much of the dialogue was recorded during COVID, because we know how long animation takes to produce, but also even the dubbing process can be, some people are just better at it than others.
Exactly. And I'll ask you this question. Do you think they would have done better if they had just voice actors instead of going the extra mile and spending the extra money to get all of these celebrities back or have little cameos from like Kevin McDonald, Simon Pegg, Nick Frost, Weird Al, Cal Penn, like in their minor cameo roles? Or do you think, would you have preferred if they got like an entirely different cast over bringing back the movie cast?
To me, and I have to give credit to Johnny Tuccello, who kind of said the same thing. Part of the appeal of bringing back the entire cast of the movie was that, and they even make fun of this in the first episode, where Scott makes a comment about Sonic the Hedgehog, and he's like, these are two different shows, but they have the same voice actor. So I think part of the appeal is because the story takes a wildly different turn from the original graphic novel,
Right.
that I think it was a deliberate choice to bring back the original cast. I'm not sure if the meta narrative would have worked the same if it was an all new voice cast.
I could see that argument being made. I liked Ellen Wong as Knives again. Mark Webber and Allison Pill were very good. Even like Brie Larson, and I like her. I think she's a great actress. She's always been a great actress, just sometimes bogged down by executive meddling, was funny for this stoic, kind of cold-hearted, selfish pop star. I guess I agree that it works more because they brought back the original cast because of where the story goes.
I hear what you're saying too. If they were trying to go for something different, then I could see the benefit of hiring just an all brand new voice cast. But I think because they had such a specific mission in mind for the story, it just made more sense to bring back the original cast. Plus, some of the guest stars are actually a lot of fun. Like, for example, Simon Pegg and Nick Frost as a pair of security guards. And this is the episode where they basically make fun of the Scott Pilgrim movie.
And a little bit of callbacks to the Hot Fuzz characters that they played.
Weird Al is the
Oh,
narrator for the documentary behind the scenes.
yeah.
That episode is just probably one of the funniest.
It is. And if you listen carefully, you can hear Tony Oliver, the voice of Lupin the Third, in there. And for Disney and a lot of animation, if you Edgar Wong, the director, which is, of course, a take on Edgar Wright. I love how it's not even clever. It's just Edgar Wrong, and it's that's just funny. That's all you needed to do. He's voiced by Kevin MacDonald, and you would know him from a lot of things. Like, most would know him from his sketch comedy background with New Kids on the Block, but you would have heard his voice in, like, Invader Zim, Amphibia, like, a lot of different shows. Lilo and Stitch as Agent Pleakley, or, like, Cat Scratch as the character Waffle, and what have you. It's, like, one of those, again, distinct voices. Now, the endings for these shows. Let's talk about them one by one. Scavenger's Reign ends with the lives of a few characters, very tragically in some regards, like that one guy who just gets crunched into bit by this plant being, or the tragic loss of, I think it was Sam, what's his name? Yeah, the commander.
Sam. Yeah.
And how he's just like, it's so close, and yet he won't be able to make it because of the encounter with that one parasitic entity that they ran into. And I knew he probably wasn't going to make it, but it still was tragic that he got so close, but he couldn't cross the finish line. The show ends for Scavenger Reigns with an encounter with the entity that came in, had a toxic codependency on, relationship with. They essentially, like, kill the alien, or, like, the alien basically encounters a revived Levi, who is now part machine, part nature, about the evolution of the world that they live in, gets destroyed, and they start a new colony down there, start a new life on there, and try to keep in touch with the ship back in space. And then we encounter Chris, who took off selfishly to leave everyone there to die on the planet. But her ship comes in contact with this more, I think, Buddhist-inspired ship. And then it ends with the people on that ship finding Chris and a little version of those Levi organic robots. And with Scott Pilgrim, it ends with them fighting an older Scott Pilgrim, and Ramona kind of coming to terms that she keeps running away from the people that she loves and all that, and how just enjoy life and the romance when it's there. Don't toxically cut out people unless, you know, something happened, of course. But the stinger ending there implies that the seventh evil ex, Gideon and
Julie,
are going to unleash some kind of plan to happen. And I think out of all three of these shows, Carol in the End of the World had the best ending of the bunch, because I feel like you can make these three shows work as just limited series. I don't think I need to see a second season of Carol. I mean, I'd be down, but there's not much you can do.
I would say Carol and the End of the World feels more complete, whereas the other two, and I am 99% positive that unless the numbers for Scott Pilgrim were just, like, through the roof and there's, like, an actual demand for more, I'm pretty sure Brian and the other creator, Ben David Grabinski, have confirmed that this is just going to be a limited series. But who knows? Stranger things have happened.
They said because of the uneven nature of working with Netflix, they were unsure if they were going to get a second season. So they wrapped it all up in 8 episodes. I just wish they didn't add that stinger at the end. Who knows? Maybe they thought this was going to be popular because Scott Pilgrim has gained a super big following that was bigger than what it was in the past, because nobody went to see the movie back in 2010. Like, now that more people love it, they'll show up and then maybe see, hey, we'll have more episodes. But it worked well for what it was. For Scavenger's Reign, I guess you could just do other planets, or just use Scavenger's Reign as a title and just do a bunch of anthology.
I would really like.
I feel like that's the only way you can go for that to have another season, because unless there's just something going on with the planet that they're on, they're surviving. That's really the end of it. They found the beautiful balance between nature and science. So, I mean, like, what do you think about these endings? Like, do you feel like you could see more from these three shows, or do you think you'd rather see the same teams make something else?
I mean, all things being equal, I would rather see more new series or movies or whatever. Like, Scavenger's Reign and Carol and the End of the World feel more, those two feel a bit more complete in terms of how the story wraps up. I would say even the same thing for Scott Pilgrim, but would I complain if a second season was announced for either of them? No, because I enjoyed all three of these quite a bit and would happily enjoy more stories with these characters. But structurally, I think they work fine as standalone seasons.
That's how I feel. And listen, I know a lot of people want their favorite shows to go on forever, but we've seen the outcome of when a show has essentially outlived itself. And not to say that there aren't like a bunch of good shows that are still going strong after a decade or two, but there are definitely some things that are going to like halt shows from going on. Like after 2020 and everything that happened there, there was no way for Brooklyn Nine-Nine to keep going, especially with the climate around police during that time period changing dramatically. And then we've seen like, and not to say that like going on forever doesn't mean that you can't do something interesting. So the most acclaimed episodes of The Simpsons came out from these last few seasons because someone said, hey, let's do something a little different now. Even like people are latching back onto Family Guy from what I've seen from my Twitter feeds, which, it, you know, grain of salt with that nonsense, but
of course,
but still something is happening with adult animation where people are expecting more from them. Like we're no longer, or like viewers are no longer wanting just the same things. There's a reason why one of the most popular shows from last year was a episodic drama, because like, not to say that they don't want prestige TV or story-driven TV. It's more people want something different. They want to either go back to more like one-off episode story of the week stuff, or if you are going to get prestige TV, they want to see more something that they haven't seen in a while or before.
Right.
And I think that's what was so great about last year was the fact that we had a lot of different stories and offerings. That's great. Unfortunately, it still seems like people are not showing up for them.
I don't know how often I can repeat myself without going insane, because I keep seeing people wanting more variety and not actively searching for it, because again, it goes back to one of my favorite sayings, people don't know what they want, they only know what they don't want.
Exactly. So I don't know what else we can say or what we can do to not let it turn into a stream of like making people feel guilty, because this is what it's like with Nickelodeon right now. People are tired of seeing the same things from all these different channels. So when they put out something new, people react negatively to it. And then it doesn't do well. And then it gets canceled. And then people rise up and are like, what the heck? And it's just like, blah, blah. It's like, y'all, you can't just continue this cycle. Blue Eyed Samurai got lucky. And I think a lot of that was because it had an action in it, but it also had a good story. But I don't know, man.
Maybe we're overthinking it. Maybe you just need something to be really that damn good. Maybe it just has, how should I say this? Something of the quality of Blue Eyed Samurai just needs to hit at just the right time for it to attract any attention.
It's just tough because a lot of that means you have to have the right talent, and not everyone is going to be the creatives behind Scavenger's Reign, Carolyn, the End of the World, or Blue Eyes Samurai. That's just not possible. But we need to get out of this comfort zone of just like, oh, you're going to be like a Family Guy ripoff, or you're going to be like Big Mouth or something. Like, even Big Mouth is coming to a close now because whatever fan base it has is starting to dry up. And I think the creative team is not going to be getting a new contract with them either. So we're about to hit a really rough spot though, because this is the year where the Animation Guild is going to be renewing their contracts. They're going to go on strike. There's no will they, it's when they do this year. And we're going to see a slowdown in productions, I think, for right now, until those strikes give the hardworking animators, writers, artists, and what have you what they need to make the great stuff that we all enjoy. So until then, y'all just need to support stuff like new and interesting ideas like Scavenger's Reign or Scott Pilgrim Takes Off or Carolyn, the End of the World. Get past your bias towards an art style. Also, you can make a great show even if it still has like that pop art look or is similar to Family Guy or whatever. A lot of the times it comes down to writing and that the team was able to make something for, like, given the time and the production pipeline was set up enough where they could do all of that and such. So, but in the end, I am glad that we have stuff like Scavenger's Reign, Carol, and Scott Pilgrim because it shows a wide variety of what we are able to do with animation, and I can't wait to see what happens this year with it. So,
My final thoughts are, if nothing else, 2023 in adult animation proves that the sky's the limit. You can tell any story you want as long as you have the right creative team. And like you said, Cameron, the right amount of resources, the time, the money, all of that, and you will get shows of the quality of Scavenger's Reign, of Scott Pilgrim Takes Off, and Carol and the End of the World. I can't wait to see what 2024 has to offer. I know things will be slowed down once we reach July of 2024, but who knows? We probably won't feel the effects of the strike until maybe 2025 or 2026, but I'm hoping this year is at least half as good as 2023.
yeah, man, I can't wait. And we'll just be doing some catch up with films that were from last year, including, I think we'll start with the big ones from like DreamWorks, Illumination, and Paramount. And then we'll be talking about the indie films. I'm not sure yet if we're going to do a animation guide of what's coming out this year, because with the strike that's going to happen, who knows what's going to happen or what's going to get delayed. And with the foreign animation scene, it's up in the air with what's going to probably be on people's radar. So you just kind of have to wait and see.
Yeah, that's kind of our MO for this year. We're going to play things by ear, but in that spirit, until next time, Cameron, where can everyone find you online?
You can find me on Twitter and Blue Sky at Cam's Eye View. I have my own website called camseyeview.biz where I review animated films and shows from around the world called The Other Side of Animation. I also have a Patreon at patreon.com/camseyeview. That's where you can find me.
And you guys can find me on various social media sites at Captain K42. You guys can check out my quick thoughts on letterboxd.com/CoachK42. And you can follow Renegade Pop Culture on Facebook and that place at Ren Pop Culture. You can also find us on YouTube, on Podchaser. Consider supporting our Patreon at patreon.com/RenegadePopCulture. Listen to all of our podcasts on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, wherever you listen. And last but not least, everything can be found at renegadepopculture.com. Need an escape? So do we. That'll do it for this episode of Renegade Animation. We will catch you guys later. Peace out.